When American writer, comedian and podcaster Jamie Loftus applied to get into Mensa, the club for geniuses, her expectations weren't high, but she took the entry test while hungover and scored in the top 2% for IQ. So she joined the group, but within weeks was blocked from Mensa's biggest Facebook group and was receiving death threats from its members. Jamie also has a podcast about the novel Lolita. She's working on a book about hot dogs. We'll mainly talk about her podcast, My Year in Mensa, today. She joins me now. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Really good, thank you. We wanted to pay tribute to your air horns with that introduction. For someone who hasn't heard your podcast, maybe you could start by talking about the air horns.
Yes. So the air horns are mainly a result of that being an independent podcast I edited on iMovie. And so I got to have kind of as much fun as I wanted with telling this story and adding in goofy sound effects to make myself laugh. I mainly edited that show to make myself laugh. And I still get flack for it now, but I think it's funny.
Yeah, I think it's funny too. There are 600 members of Mensa in New Zealand. Why did they join, and why did you join that organization?
I don't know. I'm glad that, honestly, the New Zealand numbers are so low. It seems like you guys just kind of have better things to do. But as far as why I joined, it was a combination of, to begin with, it was like I thought it was goofy, and it was also like in my darkest heart of hearts, I wanted to know if I would be able to pass the test. So it was like a combination of mockery and shame to begin with.
What is the appeal to people who aren't writing about joining Mensa? Why do you think people join?
I think that it genuinely is, for many members, it's a way to have community. And that's the lighter side of it. And then for other people, it truly is just a way to lift yourself up in a kind of, I think, kind of negative way and just feel like you're better than everyone else around you. So it's different for everybody, but there's definitely a lot of people who just want to feel better than other people.
Yeah, and intellectual snobbery is one thing, but there was a kind of a darker side to it, which we'll get to. The snobbery first, though. As a former bookstore employee, you got a bit of a taste of that in the old job, right?
Yes, yeah. I used to work at a bookstore where people would kind of bring the, you know, starter pack of someone who was kind of a jerk who just moved with big dreams. So it'd be like, how to win friends and influence people, and like the rogue copy of Infinite Jest, and just all this stuff that I was so kind of exhausted and frustrated with, just witnessing in my day-to-day life. And Mensa seems like that kind of that attitude on steroids.
You had so many men tell you that you should read the famously complicated novel Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, that eventually, as a piece of performance art, you did what?
Well, I did a lot of stuff with it. And I guess I'll just start by being like, it may be a wonderful book. I haven't read it, so I'm not even, you know, punching on the book as much as I am as the people who are recommending it. I like ate 300 pages of it in all these different ways, and then I butt chugged, you know, blended some into a smoothie and funneled it into my body also. I was trying to think of the most tactful way to put that.
You ate the book. Okay, so back to Mensa. You are quite modest in the podcast. You say you got into Mensa because you're good at taking tests. In fact, Those tests are really hard. They are proper IQ tests. You are obviously a pretty intelligent person, although you ask the question in the podcast, we pose the question, what does intelligence even mean? And is the Mensa test a good way of measuring it?
Yeah, I mean, I do as like again secretly, embarrassingly gratified as I felt at first to be like, oh, I did it, you know, I passed the test. The more I thought on it and then did research on it, it's like, well, in many ways, I am a person who would be designed to do well on that test because I, you know, it's like I'm like a white cis able-bodied lady, and I've always tested well. And so it the way that IQ tests and intelligence tests and standardized tests in a lot of American schools are designed, they are, you know, kind of the scales were kind of tipped in my favor to begin with. So, you know, I know I'm not an idiot, but I also had to recognize that it's like, well, I'm inclined to do better on these tests anyways because of kind of the insidious nature of how IQ and standardized tests tend to be designed.
Would the person who came up with the IQ test be pleased that it was being used to create an elite group of people who got to hang out with each other and congratulate each other on their smartness?
Oh, you set me up perfectly. No, absolutely not. No, I don't think so. The IQ test was originally invented by a guy named Alfred Binet as a way to just kind of gauge how kids were doing in school as an indicator to schools of what they could be doing better. And it didn't begin as kind of this individualist reflection. And it definitely, the thing that I think is most important is that IQ was never intended to be a permanent state of being. And that is exactly how Mensa treats the idea of IQ. And they operate on a different, with a different test and a different scale. But it's the same deal. They treat it as, you know, if you can pass the test once, you're a genius forever. And that's not how brains work. And it doesn't seem like a very, you know, healthy thing to tell people, especially kids, because kids are very often in Mensa as well. And I don't think that that's a very, as a kid that was like in gifted groups and was only, you know, kind of emotionally stunted by them, I don't think that they really do much good.
Nonetheless, you took the test, hungover, and you got
I did.
in. And shortly afterwards, you became a bit of a target for members of that group. To give people an idea of what may have set them off, could I, with a bit of a warning on language for our audience, ask you what the
Sure.
name of the essay you wrote about getting into Mensa was called?
Oh, yes. Let me see if I can. I think it was called Good News, Dumb Sluts Can Get Into Mensa Now, and that they did not like that at all.
It's a joke at your own expense, right?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I wrote it completely to be, I mean, it was not a very intellectual endeavor at that point. I was mostly just making fun of them and myself.
Okay, and how was the reaction to that piece being run?
It was overwhelmingly negative. And it's like, you know, I've had comedy pieces that, you know, that it's never going to go over well if you're teasing somebody, but this was like above and beyond. Like I received a death threat. It just like very intense, like personal attacks for an essay that was 95% making fun of myself. So it was just, I mean, I'd never had an experience even like, you know, whatever. If you're a woman on the internet, you're going to have experiences akin to that, but this was just turned up to an 11 in a way that I had never experienced before.
Yeah, and before we get into the content of some of those Mensa subgroups, some people listening might think, well, she applied to get into somebody else's group, then she made fun of them. It's probably no surprise that they were a little bit upset.
Sure. No, and I totally, I mean, that's a completely valid thing and something that I try to address in the podcast of I truly did start this as just a jokey way to make, you know, 50 books and have some writing published. And I wasn't really thinking about it. And I also had all these kind of assumptions that in my mind, I was, you know, punching up, because in my mind, everyone in Mensa was this like intellectualist, holier than thou jerk. And so I was like, well, I guess I don't really mind if I upset a bunch of people who are, you know, inherently snobby anyways. But that was a huge oversimplification on my part, as I kind of learned as the story continued.
I'm talking to comedian Jamie Loftus. Her podcast is called My Year in Mensa. And shortly after that, you started getting messages from people saying, hey, there's actually more to this organization. You should, I'm paraphrasing, but you should take a look at the dark side of it. And what did you find when you did?
I basically realized that I was far from the first person to receive this kind of treatment, and where I don't think I was welcoming a death threat, but I was definitely, you know, teasing the group and making fun of the group. But there were many people who had not provoked the group in any way and still were mercilessly harassed just for who they were as people. And so I realized that there was this specific group that I had been targeted in, that had repeatedly kind of spewed very, very toxic and harmful rhetoric towards other members of Mensa. And just kind of surprised me, because I assumed that it would be kind of an inherently liberal group, like snobby, snooty liberal, but liberal. And that just wasn't the case at all. It seemed to be pretty far right. Once I realized that the issue was bigger than me writing this jokey piece that you know, pissed people off, it made me realize that there might actually be something bigger going on. And if I had, you know, eyes on this goofy project I was doing, maybe I could be helpful in drawing attention to that.
Yeah, you're talking about a group called The Firehouse, which is not just some splinter sort of Facebook group. It's an officially endorsed Facebook group of Mensa, and the sort of stuff in there can be, you compared it to 4chan, but it's, you know, hard right, very racist, extremely misogynistic. Not necessarily the sort of opinions you might expect from people who were intelligent / enlightened. It kind of seemed to cater to the worst in people.
It did, yeah. And there were, I mean, and it was mostly marginalized members of Mensa who were targeted in these groups. And I think in a way that I thought of, you know, right-leaning message boards that I wouldn't go on in a million years. And here was one that was, these are supposed to be the most intelligent people in the entire world, and they're just absolutely harassing people all day long, and there's not like an intelligent thought to be found in the, you know, there's no intellectual discussion happening at all. It's mostly just cyberbullying and like right-wing memes. It was, you know, I just wasn't expecting it.
And although you went looking for them, they had heard about you, right?
Yeah. So I continued, I mean, basically I continued to write about it once I found out that there was, you know, a lot more going on than just me goofing off and poking fun at them. And from there, I started talking to people who were high up in the organization in the US, who I kind of assumed would be supportive of what I was saying of, hey, we shouldn't let, you know, members, especially officers of this organization, harass people for no reason, just based on who they are. And only to find that a lot of high-ranking members were actually posting in the Firehouse group. And just at every turn was kind of frustrated and surprised to find that this group wasn't just kind of this fringy group inside of Mensa. It definitely didn't compose the entirety of the group, but there were, you know, top ranking officers that were very supportive of its existence on the basis of, I think that you hear this again in reference to right-leaning groups often, is like, well, it's free speech. So who are we to thwart free speech, regardless of who is being needlessly targeted?
Yeah, and you note the irony in your podcast that the people who are keenest on free speech all block you en masse before you've even said anything. Some people would have just
Right.
there was enough in that Firehouse group to just write the article, but people in Mensa had said to you, Jamie, you're not giving them a chance. You need to meet these people. They're so much nicer in real life. And so you bravely decided to go to the Mensa annual get together in Phoenix and meet some of these people face to face. How did that go?
It was a very mixed bag. I don't look back on it very fondly, but it was, again, it was just I to this day I'm just like I would not do that again. I wouldn't make that choice again. But I was repeatedly told that I had to meet people in real life, and that this kind of idea that like who you are online isn't who you are in person, and that if I went there, I would have a good experience, in spite of the fact that I knew that at the previous year's gathering, there were all of these allegations of assault, of spiked drinks, and of all this stuff. So it did seem like not a very safe event to go to, and I ended up, meeting face to face many of the people who had sent me threats or harassed me, throughout the previous almost year at that point. I mean, I had face-to-face discussions with them, but certainly I don't think that it's true that you are a different person behind a screen inherently than you are in real life. Of course, that's like something that you bring to a room, but you're just not saying, you're just choosing not to say how you feel in person. But I also, met members of Mensa who very much surprised me in how supportive they were and how empathetic, and there were some people who were genuinely there for community, and then there were some people who were there because they needed to feel better about themselves and better about how they viewed themselves, and they created a very toxic community based on thinking that they're like incredible, when in reality, I mean, in many cases, it's not all super wealthy, extremely well-educated members in the group, which I think is also another false assumption I made, that I was like, oh, everyone here is going to be, college educated and like wearing an ascot. Like I was just picturing these like New Yorker cartoon characters, but it wasn't. It was like regular people. So I had a lot of my assumptions kind of challenged, but ultimately it was just it was one of the most stressful experiences of my whole life. And it was 112 degrees the whole weekend, which didn't help.
Yeah, you hilariously note that holding an annual convention in the middle of summer in Phoenix may not actually be the smartest idea, ironically.
Well, they're geniuses, so I guess what do we know?
A lot of the drama of you going to that conference is contained in the podcast. I really recommend it. It's called My Year in Mensa. I'm also partway through the Lolita podcast, which I'm really enjoying. What's the elevator pitch for that one?
Oh, thank you. That was a project I made while we were in lockdown last year. And it was kind of just a look back at Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, which was a book that I had had recommended to me by a children's author when I was 12, which is still like such a stunningly bizarre and irresponsible thing to do to me. But that's, something that happened in the mid 2000s, I guess. And I just wanted to take a look at it and see, because it seems like people who haven't even read that book or really interacted with it have a strong opinion about it. And those are the kind of subjects I'm always interested in, of like these preconceived notions that like I had about Mensa or that I had about Lolita or whatever it is, and try to get to the root of like, well, what made me feel that way if I've barely interacted with this before, and figure out actually what's going on. So that was what I was trying to do with Lolita.
No ear horns though in that one.
No, it's a bit more of a somber one. Air horns didn't feel like the move on that one, but maybe I missed an opportunity.
Yeah, that's highly recommended. Particularly, actually, you talked to, we should shout out to a New Zealand Nabokov expert whose name currently escapes me.
Yes.
Brian
Boyd. He's wonderful. Yes, he is so useful. Like the foremost Nabokov expert on the planet, I think. He was so wonderful.
And of course, the obvious next step after a critical appraisal of Nabokov's Lolita is to write a book about hot dogs, Jamie.
That was my plan. I wanted to work on a project that involved going somewhere once I could safely go somewhere. And so it was, I'm spending the next couple of months learning everything I can about hot dogs, talking to competitive eaters, and making myself extremely physically ill with a surplus of hot dogs.
Is there enough in hot dogs for a book?
Yeah, they're really like, I'm so excited about it because there's just so many angles of it that I feel like people don't really think about. There is like the small business aspect. There is the kind of darker aspects of like the meatpacking industry and what is actually in them. And are the employees treated well? Because there were a lot of kind of scandals. Like the answer is no. Then there's competitive eaters. I went to on Coney Island in New York City, they have an annual hot dog eating contest. And I saw a man from Indiana eat 76 hot dogs in 10 minutes. That I feel like is a whole chapter. And then there's like baseball culture. There's so many different ways to look at it. And also just like, I didn't really have an understanding of like, why is this an icon of American food? It's so gross as a concept, but I love it. And I'll always eat them. What is the situation with hot dogs in New Zealand? Is it popular? What's going on?
Jamie, we know about them. We import a lot of American culture, so most of us would have had one. It's not in our regular rotation, and I think probably the equivalent in New Zealand would be what you might call the corn dog, which is a sausage on a stick dipped in batter, deep fried, and then served in a brown paper bag with ketchup already on it.
Incredible. Okay. So hot dog culture is well represented in New Zealand. I just wanted to check.
You're thinking you might be able to justify a trip out here?
You know, it's like, yeah, it's technically a business expense, right? I just have to eat a hot dog in every country that I can legally go to. So yeah, I traveled the U.S. Eating every hot dog I possibly could this summer. And now I'm going to write a book about it.
Thank you for putting your giant brain to these topics. Thanks for all the laughs that you've given us. Alex, my producer, and I are big fans, and it's awesome to have you on the show. So thank you. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.